You know, he was always a rock star. He really was. That's the funny thing. He was a very shy boy. Very shy, very insecure, I would say, you know, and came from a very strict public school upbringing, very kind of repressed in a sense. And so his reaction to that was to go completely the other way, to be completely outrageous and build a character around himself, which he inhabited. And it came to its climax when he actually changed his name as well and became Freddie Mercury instead of Bulsara.
Keep yourself alive, keep yourself alive, we'll take you on your time and money.
God, Freddie is a completely self-made man. He had his vision, he had his dream, and he constructed everything about his life to make this dream happen. And we were part of this whole kind of journey.
Now I'm here.
This is Brian May.
Hi, and I'm Roger Taylor. We're from Queen.
And we're in the studio with Redbeard, of course.
Quick, what's the best-selling British band in history? No, 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 not the Beatles. That would be too obvious. Rolling Stones? Pink Floyd? Not even close. The British band that tops them all at over 300 million sold worldwide, reigning musical monarchs, is Queen. Freddie Mercury, Brian May, Roger Taylor, and John Deacon forming the band in London in 1971, the first five Queen albums have been remastered and expanded into two-disc deluxe versions, loaded with alternate takes, live performances, B-sides of singles, and newly discovered unreleased early demos. Despite their enormous popularity, Queen were never taken seriously by rock critics, points out Stephen Thomas Erlewine on AllMusic.com. And while those records were never praised, they sold in enormous numbers, and traces of Queen music could be heard in several generations of hard rock and metal bands over the next two decades, from Metallica to Smashing Pumpkins, end quote. Undoubtedly, one of the hallmarks of Queen's sound and broad appeal across continents and decades has to be the many seemingly disparate musical styles that the four band members boldly incorporated. I asked Queen drummer, singer, songwriter Roger Taylor what they hoped to sound like.
I would say we wanted to do the harmonic things, but better, that hopefully, that it, vocally, that Yes were doing, and but combine that with the wonderful, a brutal, heavy influence of what Led Zeppelin were doing. And that was at the time we started. Obviously, we changed as we went along. But I would say that more than anything else, we wanted to combine those two sort of genres.
Queen, songwriter, singer, guitarist, Brian May.
It was a vision in our head, really. I think we would have described it at the time as very heavy underneath, but very melodic and very harmonic on top. And there wasn't really a model, you know. We had heroes. Obviously, Jimi Hendrix was a huge hero. And Zeppelin were sort of almost contemporary, but they were our heroes as well. You know, they managed to do what some of what we wanted to do, but they didn't have this other side to them. We were very fond of Yes at the time, you know, who had an element. They had this very complex sort of harmonic element, which is an inspiration. But our heroes also went much further back into time. So there's people like George Formby, and the big bands, and the Temperance Seven, all sorts of strange, eclectic influences on us coalesced and became what we were. So I think we were like a sponge, and we absorbed all this wonderful music that was around us. It was a very particular time in history. It couldn't really happen now, I don't think. But we grew up with all these sounds in our heads, and we knew what we want. The lucky thing was that Freddie and Roger and I had a very similar vision in our heads. So when we came together, it was easy to know which decisions to make to try and make this happen.
I was told.
you grow a little wiser, a little better every day. But if I cross a million rivers and I rode a million miles, then I'd still be where I started, bread and butter for a smile. Well, I sold a million mirrors in a shopping alleyway, but I never saw my face in any window any day. Now they say your folks are telling you to be a superstar, but I tell you just be satisfied and stay right where you are.
Keep yourself alive, ooh, keep yourself alive.
Johnny K's. And I had a million dinners brought to me on silver tray. Give me everything I need, feed my body and my soul. Then I'd grow a little bigger, maybe that can be my goal. I was told a million times of all the troubles in my way, how I had to keep on trying and get better every day. But if I crossed a million rivers and I rode a million miles, I'd still be where I started, same as when I started.
Keep yourself alive.
Come on.
Never sounding better. That's the long-lost alternate take of Keep Yourself Alive, the original of which leads off Queen's 1973 debut. This thrilling chestnut is an example of the impressive rarities and bonus tracks now added to the Queen 40th Anniversary Deluxe remasters of their first five albums. To record that first album, the fledgling band had to grab studio time in fits and starts between David Bowie sessions at London's Trident Studio, where Queen drummer Roger Taylor joined Brian May for this interview.
Well, you're right. It was recorded mainly at nighttime when David Bowie wasn't, because we were signed to this studio, that they were our managers. This was a very fashionable studio at the time.
The owners of the studio, in a sense, owned us. They were our managers, but they didn't want to spend any money. So basically, if someone was in here like David Bowie and he finished a session at 3 o'clock, we would get a phone call and they'd say, come in, boys, you know, we've got some downtime, come in and do some work.
So we would go, you know, 2 till 6 and in the morning. And
so that's how that album was made. So we, although we had great technology around us, we didn't really have much freedom to use it. It was really grabbing little bits of time. And we were regarded as sort of the new boys who didn't really know anything, and nobody really wanted to listen to the way we wanted to do things.
Because we were being pushed slightly in, you know, towards this was the fashionable kind of sound with the drums, etc. Too dry and for us.
They put tape all over his drums and they put cushions everywhere and sound absorbing, and they made his drums go...
There's famous Trident drum sound, it was called. There was a booth that was over there. And if you imagine this big room, which is just this tiny bit of, and they used to put the drums in there and have taped up, you know, and everything, so it was dead. And that was the fashionable sound, you know, that David Bowie had used it. I think that album suffers for that, but it has a lot of good stuff on it, though.
Yesterday, my life was in ruin. Now today, I know what I'm doing. Got a feeling I should be doing all right.
From the remastered and expanded Queen debut, the song Doin' All Right has to be one of the most dynamic arrangements in rock music, an example of what AllMusic.com's Stephen Thomas Erlewine calls, and I quote, the majesty and menace in Queen's earlier work. And then there was Ferdinand Bulsara, the mercurial frontman, Freddie. Here's Brian May.
Yeah, he was always a rock star. He really was. That's the funny thing. He was a very shy boy, very shy, very insecure, I would say, you know, and came from a very strict public school upbringing, very kind of repressed in a sense. And so his reaction to that was to go completely the other way, to be completely outrageous and build a character around himself, which he inhabited. And it came to its climax when he actually changed his name as well and became Freddie Mercury instead of Bulsara. I regard Freddie as a completely self-made man. He had his vision, he had his dream, and he constructed everything about his life to make this dream happen. And we were part of this whole kind of journey.
Okay, darlings, this is a little, delicate little number called White Christmas. Tweed. So sad, her eyes smiling, dark eyes. So sad, her eyes, as if. Such a breathless night as this, on my brow the lightest kiss. I walked alone, and all around the air is safe. My lady soon will stir this way, and sorrow no one. The white queen walks, and the night mother of the willow queen. I call her name. In the window have I stayed. I love the footsteps that she made, and when she came, white queen,
so sad it is.
the stunning, majestic live performance of White Queen, a song originally on 1974's Queen 2, is all the more impressive when you realize that this London Hammersmith Odeon show dates from December 1975. What great sound! It's a bonus track now on the remastered and expanded version of Queen 2. Next, Brian May and Roger Taylor reveal which early album is a personal favorite and why. For this interview and many more, keep up with In the Studio on Facebook and visit inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard in the studio with Brian May and Roger Taylor.
Hi, this is Brian May from Queen, and welcome back to In the Studio.
I'm Roger Taylor of Queen, and welcome back to In the Studio.
And I'm Redbeard, exploring the definitive, remastered, expanded, deluxe editions of the first five Queen albums. Even though Queen's debut had received modest exposure in the U.S., Queen 2, in early 1974, had gone relatively unnoticed in the States, but the band did manage a hit from their Top of the Pops TV performance of the very British Seven Seas of Rye. Bursting with songs from all four members, Queen released another album in late 1974 called Sheer Heart Attack. Here's Queen drummer Roger Taylor.
With the second album, Queen 2, I think we sort of we did everything that we could possibly think of doing, and to the point of where we almost overcomplicated things. And I think we were starting to refine it down by then. And actually, Sheer Heart Attack is one of my own personal favorites, the album. And I think as a whole album, it stands up as well as anything we've ever done, really. Maybe other albums sold more, but for me, that's one. It's a very sort of clear statement. We'd started, that was the one that first found a sort of unified and slightly stripped down direction.
She keeps a Moët Chandon in a pretty cabinet. Anthony cake, she says, just like Marie Antoinette. A building remedy for Khrushchev and Kennedy. At any time, an invitation you can't decline. Caviar and cigarettes, well versed in etiquette. Extraordinarily nice. She's a killer. Queen, gunpowder, gelatine, dynamite with a laser beam, guaranteed to blow your mind. Ooh, recommended at the price, insatiable in appetite. Wanna try? To avoid complications, she never kept the same address. Conversation. She spoke just like a baroness. Middleman from China went down to gauge her mind. Then again, incidentally, me that way inclined. Perfume came naturally from Paris. Naturally. Because she couldn't care less. Fastidious and precise. She's a killer. Queen, gunpowder, gelatine. Dynamite with a laser beam. Guaranteed to blow your mind. Momentarily out of action, temporarily out of class, so absolutely dry. She's out to get you. She's a killer. Queen, gunpowder, gelatine, dynamite with a laser beam, guaranteed to blow your mind. Ooh, recommended at the price, insatiable in appetite. Wanna try?
The single Killer Queen was the breakthrough hit Queen needed from their third album, Sheer Heart Attack. By now, Brian May's soaring, inventive, sometimes orchestral guitar playing was starting to command respect, even in an era of guitar greats. Here's Brian May and Roger Taylor with me in the studio.
I'll be very honest with you. I never really thought of myself as a rock guitarist until about a year ago. And I suddenly thought, you know, and I discovered it when I thought it wasn't going to happen anymore. I felt like I was falling to pieces. And I thought, well, I've never really admitted that I was a rock star up to this point. I thought I was just maybe a student or...
Or sort of a women's writer for women's magazines.
Yes, you know, or a hedgehog protectionist or something.
Or a great protagonist of Save the Ant.
That's right. You know, I thought I was this guy who was sort of trying to choose his career and he was, you know, playing his guitar for a while. And I suddenly thought, well, for the last few years, I've actually been this person that other people think is a rock star, you know. So it was all a great sort of source of happiness to us. I think, you know, it wasn't like a job and it wasn't like, you know, we have to succeed. We always just assumed that we would succeed and we would, you know, people would eventually realise how wonderful we were, I think. But again, as Roger said, slightly tongue-in-cheek because it's on different levels. On one level, you think you can conquer the world and you're quite confident of it. And on the other level, you see everybody else is out there having records plays and you haven't the slightest idea how to get into the business. So there's very mixed emotions. On one level, we thought, yeah, of course it's going to be a hit. And on one level, I think it was just a joyful surprise.
Stone Cold Crazy from Queen's late 1974 Sheer Heart Attack album actually predated the punk rock and speed metal trends to come later. This was the first album cover in a series of Queen albums that pointedly carried the statement, "No synthesizers were used on this recording." Amusingly interpreted by rock critics, even to this day, as some serious musical manifesto in rebellion to technology, drummer Roger Taylor told me that it was actually a band inside joke and a compliment to the innovative guitarist that Queen had.
On the first album we ever made, Brian did a lot of stuff on guitar with featuring specific harmony guitars, which is a fairly new thing at the time. And a lot of the reviews in England, I can quote one, Chris Welch in the Melody Maker, a paper never known for its accuracy, in fact, famous for its inaccuracy, I might add, said a great use of synthesizers here. And of course, it was all guitar, and that which sort of got up our noses quite a lot. So we made a point, and the synthesizers at the time were monophonic. You couldn't play chords on them. We tried fiddling about with a big ARP in the studio once, and all we could get was something that you could make with your own body, you know, a noise that you could make
better.
And a
toilet roll.
Yeah, with your own body. And with, you know, more organic sort of overtones to it. So we was a bit put off by the early synthesizers, and decided that we would actually say from then on. I think we said it for the next four albums or so, that we had no synthesizers on those albums. And it became a bit of a little thing, you know.
Guitarist Brian May of Queen.
And there was a chemistry happening with the band. You know, we discovered that we did work off each other very well. And the band had sort of come to, I think, its first period of real maturity, having done you know, we had done some touring, as you know, and we discovered that we, you know, we fitted into it very well. The band had a life, you know, it had a life of its own, which was indisputable, and you hardly stopped to think what it was. You just knew it was there and that you were doing something which felt right.
Here I stand.
Now, don't ask me how Queen could pull off Freddie Mercury delay duetting with himself during the spectacular December 1975 Hammersmith Odeon performance of the song Now I'm Here. All I Do Know, it's one of the many bonus tracks including on the definitive, expanded, deluxe edition Queen 40th Anniversary first five albums. Still to come, Brian May reveals that Queen almost abdicated the throne after only three albums. Follow In the Studio on Facebook and visit inthestudio.net for more. I'm Redbeard, in the studio with Brian May and Roger Taylor.
Hi, this is Brian May from Queen, and welcome back to In the Studio.
I'm Roger Taylor of Queen. And welcome back to In the Studio.
Thanks again, guys. I'm Redbeard. Their fourth album, 1975's A Night at the Opera, was so successful worldwide and influential on rock music and popular culture to this day that we previously have dedicated an entire show just to it. But what is little known, even to fans of the band, is what Queen songwriter, singer, guitarist Brian May revealed to me in the studio.
We were all desperately scribbling away at the time. You know, we had a very high output, each of us separately, and there was a big struggle to sort of find out which things would go on the album. And it was a time of great release for us because we just almost had to sort of give up hope because we got into such terrible management problems and we were totally broke. And we just signed a new management deal which was going to relieve us of all our debts. And this was a guy called John Reed, who's Elton's manager. And he said, look, I'll deal with all your troubles. Go away and make an album. So we did. And the stuff just flowed out with a great sense of relief. And there was loads and loads of it.
Queen drummer, singer, songwriter Roger Taylor.
I would say it cemented our worldwide success. We'd had limited success to an extent with A Sheer Heart Attack, the album before that. But I think A Night at the Opera sort of seriously cemented that in a wider context, you know. It was a very big album in England and sort of everywhere, really. I think, and it consolidated what we'd done in America. We just started, really, with the third album. So it was the sort of clincher, in a way, in the early stage of our career.
Brian May.
For a while, put the guitar slightly towards the back, because I was so concerned with doing this job. I always felt that way anyway. I always thought that a song is primarily about singing, you know, and the guitar is wonderful if it's there, you know, and we all love guitar playing. I love the noise the guitar makes. But unless you have a good song and a good framework, you're wasting your time, you know. So in my mind, you get the song right, you get the singer right, and then you get the guitar part right.
Got my time, you're right, and got my hands on.
Tie Your Mother Down, the bombastic, thrashy rocker, comes from the 1976 follow-up to A Night at the Opera, the similarly Marx Brothers movie-inspired A Day at the Races. Volumes have been written about the production excesses from Queen and producer Roy Thomas Baker, the sexual innuendo from the very name to some of the veiled lyrics, the kitschy humor, and Freddie Mercury's prancing and preening performances. But Brian May reminded me that was only so much window dressing.
I think we always had this thing about the song coming first. You know, if the song would come in, we'd say, well, that doesn't need to be forced into a standard rock and roll mode. We should do what the song demands. So we would bring in all kinds of instruments and play around with them. And sometimes the text just got very mixed up, and it was very, very us, I suppose. Yeah, we felt very free because we had a nice... We had an audience who understood us and didn't want us to make the same kind of sound every time.
Anybody find me somebody to
stand on my feet.
Take a look, take a look in the mirror and cry.
Lord, what you doing to me? I have spent all my years in believing you, but I just can't get no relief. Lord, somebody,
somebody,
ooh, somebody,
somebody,
can anybody find me? Every day of my life, I work till I ache my bones. At the end
of the day,
I take home my
heart
on me. All of my own is tired out. My knees and eyes straight away till the tears run down from my eyes.
Lord,
somebody,
somebody,
ooh, somebody,
please.
Somebody to love.
Somebody to Love from 1976's Queen album A Day at the Races really spotlights Freddie Mercury not just as a gifted singer with an operatic range and power, but a world-class frontman, according to Brian May.
A lot of the reason that Queen succeeded was that there were other ingredients in there, you see. We were a four-piece and everybody had their area, you know, and one of the most important areas was this business of getting across. You know, the bridge between music for music's sake and the art and the listener and the audience. And really that's what Freddie did. You know, Freddie was the consummate purveyor, and I don't think he would be at all insulted by me saying that. You know, he was great at getting things across, and he said, what's the point of making music in a vacuum? I want people to hear my music.
Absolutely.
You know, and that's the way I am. You know, I was lucky to have Freddie all those years who performed that function. He's not there now, and I have no desire to live in the past whatsoever. So I said to myself, if I have a career in the future, I have to take hold of it in my own two hands. That's the only way it's going to happen. And it just happened that life had led me to that conclusion anyway. You know, I mean, we talked about this a while ago, you know, but I'd been through kind of losing a parent, losing the group, losing my marriage, losing my kids, all this sort of stuff, you know, without wishing to go into details. And to get through all that kind of stuff, you have to kind of get hold of yourself and say, right, if I'm going to survive, if I'm not going to jump off the bridge, I'm going to be my own person. I'm going to take hold of my life and put it where I think it should be.
That was Brian May explaining how he and Roger Taylor would reform Queen in the 21st century with Paul Rogers singing, even after the tragic death of Freddie Mercury in 1991 from AIDS. But Brian May still is humbled by the entire experience.
No, you know, I still think it's a dream sometimes. Sometimes I think that, you know, there's this theory that it's only me that exists and everything else is a dream. You know, I still get that feeling sometimes because everything is so incredibly, I was going to say lucky, but it's unusual in every respect. You know, we had these incredible dreams, but I think along with the sort of precociousness and the belief and the sort of belligerence of trying to achieve your dream, there's a little piece of you inside which says, no, this is impossible. We could never do this. So I still have that, you know, and I wake up some mornings and think, how did that happen? How did we become this sort of worldwide phenomenon? It's great. It's amazing. And I feel very grateful. And I think I still have a problem putting it in its place. Maybe that's lucky too.
It's so easy, but I can't do it. So easy. But I got a chance. So funny, but there's nothing to laugh about. My money is all you wanna talk about. I can see what you want me to be. I'm no fool. It's in the lap of the God.
And who could forget Queen in all of its grandeur and majesty with 100,000 singing in unison July 1986 in London's huge Wembley Stadium. Just another bonus track now included on the Queen remastered, expanded first five albums. I'm Redbeard. I'll be back in the studio after this.